Well, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. Shmuel Plotzker coming at you live from Goffmanna Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. Welcome Tyler here to the class tonight. Berlovs are traveling. I think they're in transit. They had, thank God, a simcha in Baltimore and a simcha in Chicago. And may they continue to have only happy, joyous occasions, simchas in the best of health. So let's continue our work. We are in the seventh chapter of Kings, 1 Kings chapter 7, and I gotta confess, it's hard to shine when you're being confronted by a lot of numbers over here, and there's not a whole lot of drush that I can point to make it an exciting and fun experience. It's unfortunate, but listen, it's also part of the Torah. It's canonical, and it is written with the Holy Spirit, Ruach HaKodesh, written by Nevuah, prophecy. So let us, without further ado, get right to it. We'll do as much as we can tonight. And then I took a look at the calendar, and it seems that after tonight, we're going to be off for about 4 weeks because next week is Rosh Hashanah. Then comes Yom Kippur. Then comes Sukkot. Then comes Simchas Torah. So that's literally 4 weeks in a row that our Tuesday night class will be knocked out. We just won't be able to do it. But that would give us plenty of time to review the last 7 chapters and to go forward. We have an entire month to review and move forward. Aren't you excited about that? No, really you should be, because we'll have a chance to relax and read through at your own pace. Everything should be great. Chapter 7. We left off last week having completed verse 5. So let's do verse 6 and onwards. Let's make sure we're being... Yes, we are. We are looking good, so let's keep going. Verse 6 in chapter 7. Ve'es ulam ha'amud. This is a continuation. Solomon is building things. He's building his own house. According to some, he's building a house for himself. According to others, he's building what we're going to see right now. He's perhaps building a place for the Sanhedrin to sit. So let's go see what it's all about. Verse 6. Beis ulam ha'amudim asa chamishim ama orko ushloshim ama rochbo. And the porch of amudim, of pillars, he made a porch of pillows, of pillars, not pillows. See where my head is? You see where that's a long hot day. I'm thinking, oh, a porch of pillows. Man, that sounds great. No, we're not ready for the pillows just yet. And he made the porch of pillars, P-I-L-L-A-R-S, Chamishim Ama Orko, 50 cubits its length, Ushloshim Ama Rochbo, and 30 cubits its breadth, V'ulam Al-Penehem, and a porch in front of them, V'amudim V'ov Al-Penehem. And pillars and thick beams before them. Okay? That's what it says in the verse. Let's see what Rashi can add to us. Let me just make a bracha. Hot day here in Cincy, 92 degrees. Hopefully it's cooler where you are. Verse 6. We'll read Rashi in the English in the footnote. And the porch of pillars. He made a porch before these pillars as an entrance to the house. Its length was 50 cubits along the width of the house, which was also 50 cubits. So the length is 50 cubits, the width is 50 cubits, and 30 cubits its width before the extent of the length of the house. Only that the longer measurement is always called the length, and the shorter one is called the width. Okay? And a porch before them. In addition, says Rashi, he made a high porch around the entire house. And pillars and thick beams before them. Says Rashi, and on the cut beams of cedar, which were no longer pillars, he erected more pillars and joists from pillar to pillar, the pillars to connect walls from one to the other, and the joists to cover the ceiling. And the word ov is a joist, as we learned in Bava Kamma. The ubim, these are the joists. The joists. Yeah, it's tough word to say. So that's Rashi. The Mitzvahs maintain that these were pillars driven into the earth, joined at the top by thick joists to keep them together, either for the sake of beauty or as a wall and guard. Okay, I wish I had more to elaborate on this, but like I said many a time, I'm not an architect or a designer, and so it's not really speaking to me, unfortunately. I really need somebody to kind of render a drawing. At all events, verse 7. Ba'ulam hakise, in a porch, the ulam, usually the word ulam means like hall or hallway or palace of a sort. Ba'ulam hakise, and the porch for the throne, asher yishpot sham, upon which he would judge, ulam hamishpat asa, he made a porch of judgment. You know, when I see the word kise, I just crack up. I'll tell you why. I think you're all gonna, you're all gonna get this. When you're growing up in a religious environment and you need to use the bathroom, you'll excuse me, but listen, if I gotta crack a joke, almost anything goes. So kids, when they ask their rabbi, can I go to the bathroom, if they want to put it into Hebrew, they say, I need the base hakise. Now, the word kise means seat or chair. But it also, when you're talking about a king, it's going to mean a throne. Because it just does. Because the word kise means chair or seat. And in a context where you're talking about a king, well, then that chair or seat in regards to a king is his throne. That's not very, rocket scientist. So the kid says, where is the house of the seat? Where is the house of the chair? Or, of course, it could mean, where is the house of the throne? So when a from kid goes to Israel for the first time, and he asks for the bathroom, and he asks for the house of the chair, or the house of the seat, there's an awful lot of snickering going on because nobody in his right mind in Israel calls the bathroom the house of the chair, the house of the seat. Everybody, all together now, all 17,000 of you, how do we call, again, forgive me, how do you call the facilities in Hebrew, modern Israeli Hebrew? Well, I just gave you the answer. The word is sherutim, facilities. That's how people refer to the water closets of Israel. Where are the facilities? It's a nice way to say it. Where are sherutim? Where are the facilities? And so, down the block, down the hall. So that's where you go. But nobody uses a 2,000-year-old term, the base hakise, the house of the throne, the house of the seat. It just sounds so hilarious. Does. What can I tell you? I'm laughing even now. Anyway, that's my little joke, and I'm getting it when I see the word ulam hakise screaming at me from verse 7. 1 Kings chapter 7, verse 7, the hallway of the throne. Well, of course, in Solomon's time and in the Bible, that makes perfect sense, that you would say ulam hakise, the hallway of the throne, because we are talking about a king. And we're not talking about a bathroom. We're talking about where the king sits when he's in judgment, not where the king sits in other times of the day. But to use that phrase and make kids think that this is how we speak Hebrew, I mean, maybe in Borough Park, but man, as soon as you get off that plane, you better ask somebody who knows something, how do I get to the bathroom and how do I say the word bathroom here in Hebrew, in Israel? Anyway, I've said it enough. Enough's enough. Ulam hakise. So he made a porch for the throne so that he'd be able to judge. And that's known as the Porch of Judgment. And it was covered, the Safun Ba'erez, it was covered with cedar, Me'akarka Arakarka, from one side of the floor to the other. So it is. So it says over here. Okay, so let's see if we can flesh some stuff out. A porch for the throne. Seems we're going to have a little bit of a disagreement between the Radak and the Malbim. Let's see how and why. The Radak, we're told, says, the porch of judgment is Ulam HaMishpat, this hallway, hall of judgment, and the porch for the throne, and the Ulam HaKiseh, says the Radak, they're one and the same. It's strange to say that, because it seems from here, I think you could argue that they're two distinct things. He made a porch for the throne where he might judge. And then, of course, it does say the porch of judgment. It looks like our translator is following the Radak very carefully. But you could just as well argue he made a porch for the throne so that he might judge. He made a porch of judgment. Two different places. And sure enough, the Malbim is going to go there, I think. Let's take a look. Or, as the Targum says, a porch to set the throne of judgment to judge there. He made a vestibule to the house of judgment there. Prusta, and where is that word coming from? Yes, in the Targum, prusta is an expression of prosdor, a vestibule. And that word prosdor is used in contemporary Israel. It's certainly used in the literature, in the rabbinical literature. You see that term. Everything is a prosdor. I think the rabbis use that term in Pirkei Avos. But I got to just confirm that there is, that this world is just a, you know, an anteroom. The rabbis try to teach that this world that we're living in for 60, 70, 80, 100 years is just an anteroom, a prosdor, a pre-room before you get to heaven. And that's the eternity place. That's the place for forever and forever. How that stems with coming back to earth and living here on earth under Mashiach is a machlokas, a disagreement between Maimonides and Nachmanides, if I recall, as to how the future is all going to pan out. But nobody is really sure about how that's all going to play out, and the Almighty is not talking too much. And when he does, it's very cryptic. So we have to just kind of bide our time and just have faith in God. He's all going to make it good, and wherever hopefully we wind up, we'll be in a good place. Prosdor is an expression of prusdor, rather. Prusta is an expression of prosdor, a vestibule. So says Rashi. There were then two porches. The porch for the throne, this is the Malbim now, 19th century scholar, the Malbim, Remeir Leibish Malbim, I forgot his last name. There were then two porches. The porch for the throne was for the use of the king in judging important matters. That's the porch for the throne. Whereas the porch of judgment was for the use of the Sanhedrin and for the litigants to stand there before the porch of the throne. So think of it as a lahavdil, as an American courtroom. You've got a judge all the way up on the bench, and then you've got what's called the well. The well is where the lawyers sit as they conduct a trial or a hearing, and the parties are allowed to sit next to, obviously, their attorneys in the well. Each party takes a desk, and they face the judge. And unless you're admitted to the bar, you're not really walking into that well. And instead, you get to sit with the public. So over here, we've got a porch of judgment. That was where the rabbis and the scholars sat, the members of the Sanhedrin, And also the litigants stood there, okay, and they stood there before the porch of the throne. Okay? Do I hear somebody? I don't. We continue. It was covered with cedar. This porch, maybe it's the same exact place according to the Radak. For the Malbim, they're two different places. It was covered with cedar. And that's in the singular. The earth of the floor was covered with cedar. It was covered with cedar. That's what it says in the text. Pesafun ba'erez. It was covered with cedar. It says Rashi, the earth of the floor was covered with cedar. And then make hakarka ad hakarka, from one side of the floor to the other. Jonathan renders, this is Rashi speaking, Targum Yonathan renders this from foundation to foundation, meaning from the base of this wall and until the base of this other wall, which was opposite, the entire floor was covered. So says Rashi. Good. Verse 8. We're just flying through. Uveso asher yeshev sham, and his house where he would dwell, where he might dwell. Chatzer ha'acheres mibeis la'ulam. How are we going to translate that? Chatzer ha'acheres. Excuse me, there was another, was in the other court, mibeis la'ulam, within the porch, kama'asa hazeh haya. It was like a similar work. So they translate in the Judaica press, and his house, he might dwell, was in the other court, within the porch, was of the like work. So I guess you would say, and his house in which he might dwell was in the other court within the porch, and that was similar. Uvayis Yaaseh Levas Paro, and the house which he would make for Paro's daughter, Asher Lokach Shlomo, whom Shlomo had taken as a wife, Ka'ulam Hazeh, was like this porch. So according to, well, let's just let the commentators flesh it all out. So the house in which he might dwell was in the other court, was within the porch. It was similar. And the house which he would make for Paro's daughter, whom Shlomo took as a wife, was like this porch. Okay, let's see what the Mefarshim say. His house where he might dwell, referring to a complete residence, to both eat and sleep there. This was the house mentioned at the beginning of the chapter. So says Rashi and the Ralbach. Okay, and he says within the porch. Mi beis la'ulam. Kama se hazeh. Okay, let's try within the porch. All right. This house was situated inward from the porch of the house of the forest of Lebanon. In other words, entering the palace grounds. So says Rashi in the Mitzvot David. And it was similar, it was of like work. Like the work of the porch of judgment, the doors were covered with cedar, says the Ralbag and says the Mitzvot David. And the house which he would make, which ultimately he made for Paro's daughter, says Rashi, he planned to make a house for the daughter of Paro. And the Rabbeinu Yeshaya says, because of all his wives, Shlomo held her, the daughter of Paro, in the highest esteem. Okay? Ka'ulam hazeh, it was like this porch. like the work of this porch, whose floors were of cedar, says Rashi the Rabbag in the Mitzvot David. There were in all 8 sections built. The king's residence, and before it the great court, and before it the house of the forest of Lebanon, and before it the porch of pillars, and another porch before that, and the pillars with the joists before them, and then the porch for the throne, and finally the porch of judgment. So says the Malbim. Those are the 8 sections built. Verse 9. Kol eila avanim yekaros kemidos gazis megoraros bamegera mibayis mechutz. All these were avanim yekaros, were precious stones. Kemidos gazis, according to the measures of hewn stones, megoraros, sawed, bamegera, with a saw, mibayis mechutz, inside and outside. Umimasad ad hatefachos, umichutz ad hachatzar hagadola. Okay. And from the foundation up the coping, and from the outside until the great court. All these were precious stones. All these houses, according to the measures of hewn stones, sawed with saws in and out, and from the foundation up the coping, and from the outside until the great court. Okay, let's go ahead and see. And above were precious stones. Kol eila avanim yekaros. All these were precious stones. Are we at the end yet? No, we're not. Let me just see. Okay, there we go. Number 9. Verse 9. All these were precious stones. All of these structures which he built, like the house of God, the temple, like his own palace, and like the house of judgment, and the house of Pharaoh's daughter, and their courts, the stones used for them were made heavy. So Rashi and the Radak and Targum Yonasan, they're going to have a disagreement. Sorry, they have a disagreement as to how to understand the term avanim yekaros. Does it mean precious stones? Simply put, does it mean that there were a lot of diamonds and rubies and sapphires? Is that what's meant? Or does it mean that, well, let them flesh it out. Others said that they were precious and of exceptional quality. So there you have it. When some see the words avanim yekaros, precious stones, for some it means they are just extremely expensive. They're precious in quality and they're exceptional in their quality. But others say no. Rashi says it just means that the stones were heavy. Heavy stones. All right. Got a whole bunch of good chips over here to look at. Here we go. According to the measures of hewn stone, the midos gazis megoraros b'megera mibayis mechutz. According to the measures of hewn stones, sawed with saws within and without. You know what's funny? As we were driving up to Oxford University, that's in England. As we were driving up to Miami University for a barbecue yesterday on Labor Day at the Chabad House, a Chabad House that's really very nice and very nicely run, very warm and friendly. Had a lot of good college kids over there enjoying the food, making their own chauffeurs. And along the way, you see a sign that says, interested in exploring Catholicism, call, this church and this phone number. And what could I tell you? I mean, if you wanted to put a joke up on a billboard, it could not have been a funnier one than Are you interested in exploring Catholicism right now in the wake of the Pennsylvania grand jury report and all the craziness going on in Argentina, other places in the United States, Ireland, Australia, etc.? No, I think I'm going to pass on that one. But thanks very much for the offer. Okay, we continue. I don't know what brings that up. Just my head is just going in a dozen different places. According to the measures of hewn stone, and that's what makes this class so much fun. That's why you're all listening in. What's going to come out of that crazy guy's mouth next? Anything is possible. According to the measures of hewn stone. Literally, according to the measures of hewn, H-E-W-N, of cut, according to the measures of cut, Camigos Gozis, to the measure of cut. That's technically what it means. That's a very literal translation. Rashi therefore explains this was, that this was according to the measures of hewn. Well, it's got to be cut something. Can't just let it be Tamidos Gozis according to the measurements of cut. Cut what? Cut stone. Meaning there was one accepted measurement. There's one accepted measurement for hewn stone in that country. There was one and only one accepted measurement. So says Rashi, the Radak, the Ralbag, and the Mitzvot. Okay, so a Megora Ros by Megera sawed with saws. A saw cuts, he writes, this is Rashi, I'm sorry, Radak and Ralbag. A saw cuts stone very smoothly, in contrast to a makeva, a sledgehammer, which does not cut very smoothly. I think it's fair to say that. And from the foundation up to the coping, umi masad ad hatzafachos, and from the foundation up to the coping, this building was made in the height of hewn stones from the foundation until the highest beam. Okay? We continue. And from the foundation, umi masad, and from the foundation, the word masad is derived from the expression yesod, a foundation. And as long as we're going down this little path, how do you say institution in Hebrew? Well, how do you say this premier spy agency in Israel? The Mossad. The Mossad. Now, you go to Cleveland and you ask a little yeshiva bacher, where do you go to school? And he's going to say, Moistos. Moistos is how to say that word, Mossad, in yeshivish Hebrew in the plural. He goes to Moistos of something, the institutions of something. But how do you say institution in Hebrew? Mossad in the singular. And the Mossad is the institution in Israel par excellence. Are very selective, and they do a lot of good work. So that's the Mossad. They're the CIA of Israel, or the NSA of Israel. We continue on. The coping. I want you to know we had a great time over there last night. It was just a beautiful time. Food was great. We really enjoyed it. I'd go back for a free barbecue in a heartbeat. But we did give a little donation, and we bought some sweet corn along the way. It was very nice. We continue on. The coping. Okay? Masar ad hatzfachos and mechutar ad hatzfachos. Up to the coping. The highest beam. The coping ad hatzfachos means the highest beam. And they quote a pasuk in Isaiah, chapter 48, verse 13. My right hand had spanned the heavens. I don't think we have an English Isaiah here. We did. We'd look it up. I think he's inside in the other holding in the other room, other building. Unless you've got an all-purpose Tanakh. And of course, thank you, my man, found one. So let's go to Isaiah chapter 48, verse 13. You know, kids, once we finish off 1st and 2nd Kings, what do you think is going to be? Who comes up after that? Isaiah comes up after that. Isaiah is like a lifetime study. That would be the greatest, to me anyway, just an incredible privilege to try to shed some light on this great book. According to what I read, it is the single most cited Hebrew book of the Bible. Second, if it's second at all, it's second to Psalms. And if it's not second to Psalms, then it is the primo, most darshaned, most commented on book of the Hebrew Bible by the rabbis, the book of Isaiah. Thought I read that somewhere. So let's go take a look at 48:13. Okay, Af yodi yasta eretz v'mini tzipcha shamay korani aleihem ya'amdu yachta. Okay, the previous pasuk is really one for the books. Shema Ela Yaakov Yisrael Mekorai. Listen to me, Jacob and Israel. Mekorai. He's called by me. Ani hu, I am he, says God. Ani Rishon, Af ani Acharon. I am the first, and I'm also the last. And that's the Jewish source for the Almighty God being first and last. That's the Jewish source for that idea. And that is our idea that God himself, and God only, is Rishon V'Achron. Next pasuk, Af Yodi Yasta Eretz. My hand also created the land. V'minin, my right hand, Tipcha Shamayim. The pech over here, I see he translates, has measured out the heavens. A tefach. It's a measurement. Koreani aleihem, I call out to them, ya'amdu yachtav. That they should all stand together. Or that they do indeed, right now, stand together. So that's the pasuk. Isaiah 48:13, my right hand has spanned the heavens. See that? Af yodi yasta eretz v'mini tipcha shemayim. V'mini, my right hand, tipcha shemayim, according to the art scroll, my right hand is measured out the heavens, and according to this Judaica, my right hand has spanned the heavens. And the word tipcha, according to this, describes the heights of the heavens. Okay, Tefach was also, and that's Rashi, Tefach was also the name given the stone upon which the beam was placed because it usually protruded a Tefach beyond the wall. Okay, so Tefach is also the name given to the stone upon which the beam was placed because it usually protruded a Tefach beyond the wall, right? Tyler, thanks for giving me that Tanakh. Really appreciate it. And from the outside, umichutz ad achatzer hagadola. And from the outside, says Rashi, on the outside, the entire length of the walls were made of these stones until the great court. All right, verse 10. Umiyusar avanim yekaros avanim gedolos. And the foundation was of precious stones. Avanim yekaros. precious stones. Did we see that already? Well, I guess I saw that elsewhere. Umiyusar avanim yikaros avanim gidolos. And the foundation was of precious stones, avanim gidolos, great big stones. Avnei eser, stones of 10 cubits. Avnei eser amos, stones of 10 cubits. Avnei shmona amos, and stones of 8 cubits. Okay. Let's read that again. The foundation was made of precious stones, great stones, stones of 10 cubits and stones of 8 cubits. Let's see the footnote. And the foundation was of great stones. And the foundation, which was in the ground, was of stones greater than the measurements of hewn stones. Okay. Says Rashi, although the stones of the foundation were like the stones used for the walls, as mentioned in verse 9, that was a reference to the quality of the stone, not the size, rather the quality of the stone. Our sages say further in Talmud 26a that these stones projected inward to the temple and were used as resting places for the elder priests, whereas the younger priests would rest on the ground, since no beds were allowed into the temple. Wow. So says the Radak and the Siddur's David. 11 Yeralef. Milamala avanim yikaros timidos gazes va'ares. And above were precious stones according to the measures of hewn stones and cedars. Again, and above this foundation were precious stones, according to the measures of hewn stones and cedars. Take a look. And above were precious stones. And above the stones used for the foundation were precious stones, hewn to precisely, cut to precise measurement until the coping, as he mentioned above. And cedars, according to the measures of hewn stones and cedar trees. As Jonathan explains to Targum Yonason, he covered it with boards of cedar, as said before in chapter 7, verse 7, and it was covered with cedar. Verse 12, the Chatzer HaGadola Saviv, Shlosha Turim Gazis Vitur Krusos Arazim. And the great court round about was of three rows of hewn stones and a row of cut beams of cedar. Velachatzar Beis Hashem Apanimis Ula Ulam Habayis. And for the inner court of the house of God and for the porch of the house. Okay, take a look. And the great court round about, the great court encircled all the king's houses. Wow, that's kind of big, says the Metzudas David. It was of three rows of hewn stones. The wall around the great court was made of three tiers of hewn stone and one tier of cut cedar wood on them, and continued in this order until the top of the wall. The Abarbanel writes, the prophet was very brief in his reference to and description of the royal palace and the house which Solomon built for Paro's daughter, since there was nothing spectacular in its construction except for the stones and the cedar. And that's the reason why the prophet was so brief, because there was nothing terribly exciting about it. Nothing points up. On the other hand, he was most lengthy in the details of the house of the house of the forest of Lebanon, due to the pillars and windows and size, which portrayed Solomon's greatness and wealth. We're going to finish up verse 12 and call it a night. It's been extremely hot, and it's not getting much cooler in this room, unfortunately. And for the inner court of the house of God and for the porch of the house, these two were built of three tiers of stone and one tier of cedar, as was the wall of the great court, says the Radak of Rambag in the Mitzvot. And finally, the Aderes Eliyahu says, these structures had one thing in common. They had no ceiling and were therefore reinforced with cedar to hold them. All right, people, it's 8:15. We've been going strong since about 7:30. A little humor mixed in here and there to kind of break it up a little bit. There's more of the same. You know what? That's a little bit more. Because here, no, oh, thank you. That is really good, Tyler. That's much better. I feel it. That's good. So we'll go into the pasuk. Vayishlach HaMelech Shlomo v'yikach Shechiram Mitzor. King Solomon sent and fetched Shechiram out of Tyre. Wow, this is the first part of the first narrative we're getting in a very long time. See that Abarbanel, this was not Shechiram the king, but rather it was the name of a skilled worker. You would have thought maybe it's Shechiram the king, but that would have been wrong. Because in the next pasuk we get a biography of this man. Ben Isha Almanahu, he was a widow's son, Mimate Naphtali, of the tribe of Naphtali. The Aviv Ish Sorer, I'm sorry, Aviv Ish Sori, Choresh Nechoshes. His father was a man of Tyre, Choresh Nechoshes, a coppersmith, Bimale Es Hachokma, Ves Hatavuna, Ves Hadas. Okay, he was a coppersmith, a Choresh Nechoshes, and he was filled with the wisdom and the understanding and skill to work all works in copper. He came to King Solomon and he worked all his work. He did every single thing he was supposed to do. Let's see this footnote, and then maybe we'll end it there. He was a widow's son, Ben Isha Almanahu. He was a widow's son, we're told. He was most likely unmarried and was therefore with his mother in order to console her in her widowhood. This fact increased the difficulties of parting. Okay? He was from the tribe of Naphtali. He was of the tribe of Naphtali, but his mother was of the tribe of Dan. So it says in 2 Chronicles, chapter 2, verse 13, and they sojourned in Tyre. They were traveling and they stopped off in Tsor, in Tyre, so says Radak. We find a striking parallel in the construction of both the tabernacle in the desert and the temple in Jerusalem. The same two tribes collaborate in the work. In the interim, the same two tribes, Dan and Naphtali, collaborate in the work. In the Mishkan, in the tabernacle, it was Bezalel of the tribe of Yehuda and Eliab, the son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan. In the construction of the temple, too, Chiram was from the tribe of Dan on his mother's side, Solomon, the son of David, from the tribe of Yehuda. Okay? A man of Tyre, Ish Tsori, a man coming from Tyre. He resided there a long time, says the Mitzvot David. A coppersmith, Choresh Nechoshes. The common word for this is Uman. It matters very little, if at all, the exact occupation of his father, other than to inform us that a son is obligated to learn and engage himself in his father's trade. So says the Gemara in Erechin 16b. Okay? Since his father was deceased, Solomon took the son to replace him, knowing that he was capable and of equal skill. And he was filled with the wisdom and understanding and skill. What does that mean? These are the three tools with which the universe was created. As it stated, the God, the Almighty, by wisdom founded the earth. By understanding, he established the heavens. By his knowledge, the depths were broken up. With these same three, the temple was built. Okay? Lasos Komalacha Banachoshes, to work all works in copper. In 2 Chronicles, he's described as skillful to work in gold, silver, copper, iron, stone, and lumber, purple, blue, and fine linen, and in crimson, and to do whatever it is, or whatever is set before him. It is without doubt that he possessed all these attributes, but since Solomon had no need for any but his skill in copper, there was no need to mention the others. The fact that he knew how to do so much. Mob maintains that Solomon originally had the services of the father of this individual, Hiram, whose name incidentally was this name. The elder Hiram was skilled in all those trades mentioned in 2 Chronicles. He passed, however, after 7 years, and Shlomo sent for the son, who was already skilled only in the works. And then Solomon sent for the son, who was skilled only in the works of copper. The wordings in the text, both here and in 2 Chronicles, seem to bear out his interpretation. Okay, we'll call it a quits for tonight. Sorry about this, everybody. We finished off over here at verse 13, and we're going to pick it up, God willing, in a month. It's the very first Tuesday available that we can all meet, in which I don't have any court-related stuff. Looking at my calendar, I've got a lot of stuff coming up, all these various cases that I'm juggling. So we're off for the next 4 weeks. I wish everybody a healthy, happy new year. A wonderful last few days of the year. Make them all good. The Misake in all the days of the year, in these last individual days of the year. And with God's help, we should have all of us a healthy, happy new year. And wishing everybody all the best. We'll see you all in a month. Take care and be well. Bye for now.